Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I'm on. Well, welcome to MERPCON 2, and welcome to my presentation. I'm Michael Martinez, the author of Visualizing Middle Earth, Parma and Dorian, Essays on Middle Earth, and Understanding Middle Earth, Essays on J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth. Notice how I manage to say Middle Earth very often. I'm going to start out tonight. We're MERPCON, of course, is a convention for gamers who specialize in Tolkien world-type gaming. So I'm going to read to you, start out with a little essay I wrote for Immeo Source, We Just Died. And it's called The Belt Buckle of Truth. It was an essay I wrote last year that anticipates the Lord of the Rings Online game. So here we go. Let's face it. If I had been a member of the Fellowship of the Ring, Aragorn and Boromir probably would have left me behind in Moria. I would have gotten caught up in arguing with the other members over whether the Balrog really had wings or if they were just an illusion it was casting with its power. By the way, the No-Wingers camp should try that one on for size and see what they can make of it. Gandalf might have been amused at my attempts to pin down Elrond on just how many great princes and captains there would have been at the breaking of Thangorodrim versus the marshalling of the hosts of the last alliance of elves and men. Sure, he was there on both occasions, but did he actually take names? After all, except for Elendil, Isildur, Gil-galad, and maybe one or two others, he doesn't really mention anyone. Why is that? Gimli probably would not have had much to say to me. After all, dwarves don't really care much for the details of history. They know someone done their granddaddies wrong, and that is good enough for them. Had Thorin paid closer attention to matters when he fled Erebor with his father and grandfather, he probably would have figured out that there was a secret door somewhere. Maybe he could have asked them if they had stopped to carve a dual curse on the gold jar, which is pictured in conversation with Smaug. Boromir would have liked me the least. I would have been rubbing his nose in his lack of proper royal credentials at every opportunity. He had a pretty snide sense of humor, always picking on other people and belittling them. I don't like people who behave that way. It's just so petty. He didn't deserve to be King of Condor. Who did he think he was, aspiring to royal status anyway? His brother had a right sense of place and duty. Now, the hobbits and I would have had a blast. They were always getting into trouble. Heck, I would have been right there beside Sam, comforting Frodo on Weathertop, saying obsequious things like, "Hey, anyone would have put that ring on. It wasn't your fault. By the way, are you going to eat that trail bread?" Pippin and I would have traded barbs back and forth all day, quick one-liners, bad puns, singing songs off-key. Merry would probably have been good for a practical joke or two. As a Bucklander, he probably spent a great deal of time lobbing corn cobs at the farmers in the Marish, meeting their daughters behind haystacks and lighting fires underneath the trees of the old forest. Legolas would have struck me as odd. Of course, I probably wouldn't have gotten to say a word to him on most days anyway. What Tolkien didn't bother to tell us is that he had a girlfriend at every trail stop and roadside inn. And yes, elves do sleep in bed, so why on earth would they want to pass up a flea-ridden bed in a local human inn? Leggy and I would have had a few flirting contests to see who would snag the most smiles and hair twirls, but he would win. We all know that. You see, that is really what adventuring in Middle-earth should be all about. Hanging out with the nine dudes, just cruising from great moment to great moment, sneaking in some quality backstage time while the great debates rage in Elrond's council. You know that 2 months the Fellowship spent in Rivendell before starting out for Eregion? That would be some immense magic-making time, folks. Imagine all the spells we could entice Gandalf and the elves to lay on our swords, our armor, our trail bed. For that matter, any good alchemist knows you can enchant anything. Me, I want a belt buckle that would force anyone to tell me the truth, no matter how hurtful it might be to their reputation. You see, if I were to make it across the Anduin with Sam and Frodo, I wouldn't put up with all this swear by the precious nonsense that Frodo found to be so fair and just. Nope. I would just have laid Gollum down and said, "All right, Gollum, either you start telling us how to get into Mordor or I take off my belt." And then I would want boots of hobbit chastisement. You see, traveling with four hobbits is a bit like herding cats. You can only put up with so much whining about, "When do we eat again?" and "I am wasting away to a wraith." Enough of that garbage. With my boots of hobbit chastisement, I'd give them a swift kick and everything would be okay again faster than you can scream, "Fool of a Took." Now, no good adventurer can go on the road without a +9 magic sword of foe slaying and monster taming. After all, that is what Farmer Giles had when he met Chrysophilax, right? So clearly, Tolkien had one lying around in the closet. Elrond's elvish smiths probably would have needed a little practice before reforging Narsil anyway, and they had 2 months, for crying out loud. Add to that my leather jerkin of arrow repulsion, so no one would mistake me for a big warrior or a dumb wizard in robes. My backpack of endless useless items. I'm sorry, my backpack of endless useful items, a full set of dishes, a tea set, a tablecloth, cheese, crackers, cookies, ambiguous leafy green things, bread, milk, onions, potatoes. Was there any room for anything useful on that poor pony's back? After all, I just skipped half the paragraph. Let me back up here. Can you imagine Sam trying to pack Bill the pony with all the crazy stuff hobbits carry? Ooh, I really messed up. Can we back this up? Okay. All right. Now, oh, okay. You want me to start it over?
No.
Okay. All right. Now, I know. Now, no good adventurer can go on the road without a +9 magic sword of Flo's saying, Flo's... That's really easy for me to say. Now, no good adventurer can go on the road without a +9 magic sword of foe slaying and monster taming. After all, that is what Farmer Giles had when he met Chrysophilax, right? So clearly, Tolkien had one lying around in the closet. Elrond's Elvish smiths probably would have needed a little practice before reforging Narsil anyway, and they had 2 months for crying out loud. Add to that my leather jerkin of arrow repulsion, so no one would mistake me for a big dumb warrior or a dumb wizard in robes, my backpack of endless useful items, my rope of everlasting tension, my self-heating cooking pots and pans, my +5 whip, and my fishing net of sustenance, and I would be set to go. Can you imagine Sam trying to pack Bill the Pony with all the crazy stuff hobbits carry on their road trips? I mean, silk hankies, white cakes, beer, ale, wine, a full set of dishes, a tea set, a tablecloth, cheese, crackers, cookies, ambiguous leafy green things, bread, milk, onions, potatoes. Was there any room for anything useful on that poor pony's back? After all, the party could have used a tent of many rooms, impervious to both rain and hail, and capable of sustaining up to 4 inches of snow. 2 months is just such a long time to sit in Rivendell, doing nothing but twiddling your thumbs. I would have driven Gandalf nuts with my constant, when are we going to leave? Not just yet. So, can I get you to cast some spells for me? No. Now leave me alone. I would have had it all worked out, too, assuming Elrond had 4 alchemists and a couple of magicians sitting around the house, swapping lies and old stories. I could have had them churning out magical glow-in-the-dark at will, armor for the hobbits, a couple of fly spells later, and we'd all have breaches of fast travel. Forget the eagles who were soaring over Mordor on the wings of elven bellbottoms, dudes. It's so righteous. Legolas would have had 2 quivers of multiple critical arrows, a couple of explosive fireball arrows, at least 1 arrow of teleportation, and a bow of defense with a +25 shield and a full set of deflection bonuses. No orc arrow would ever come near him. Boromir's silly horn would have been replaced with a fully symphonic bardic sound system and a leather cap, completely embedded with spells of sound control, ambient setting, and momentous declarations. He would have had a cloak of total warmth, a belt of deflection, and a saddle of shadow steed so that he could ride across the mountains and bring help if necessary. Now, Aragorn would need something special. Being the rightful king and all, I would say he deserved more than the cheap junk I've mentioned so far. To begin with, to go with Arwen's banner, he would need a proper skyship of cloudbursts, capable of carrying up to 4,000 men and stocking enough provisions to feed them for a year. It would travel 100 miles per day and reach altitudes of 25,000 feet. There would be air conditioning, a DVD studio, and fully functional toilets with a complete recycling system. The ship would move by stealth mode at night, meaning it would not block out any stars, and there would be a trap door in the bottom just in case anyone needed to make a quick escape or to drop a pesky ring into Mount Doom. I think the chief of the Rangers of Eriador would also need a saddle of horse flight for his noble steed, Rohirrim. Rohirrim would be able to clear tall mountains with a single bound. And, naturally, Aragorn would have to have a cloak of ranger stealth which enabled him to hear conversations 100 miles away, launch successful ambushes against 10-to-1 odds, and heal any mortal wound inflicted upon any of his faithful companions. Just for good measure, I would have Elrond write up a scroll of inspiration so that Gimli could read it off when we were facing down the horde of orcs in Moria. I haven't figured out why or how we'd need to get that ship into Moria, but who wants to miss a chance to get some experience by killing the Balrog with a dagger of Maiaric banishment? I'm telling you, if Tolkien had let me wander through Middle-earth, the War of the Ring would have been little more than a footnote in the annals of alchemy. So bring on the Middle-earth Online. I'm pumped. And that's pretty much how I would handle any role-playing game. As Hawk has learned this weekend, you give me a magic user, a magician capable of creating devices or anything like that, and any sort of time frame, and I will turn into a magic factory as long as I have 6 or 7 dozen fighters between me and all the bad guys. So I do have role playing experience. I gamed with a group in Atlanta for about 13 years, and we carved new rules out for Iron Crown Enterprises in their Rolemaster system by doing things that they never thought of. And when people called them up, they would say things like, "You guys play a vicious game." And they would put little notes in the next Rolemaster Companion, like, "Teleportation cannot be used as a weapon," where you blow up somebody's head by putting something into it. Well, they didn't say we couldn't do it to begin with, so we went ahead and did it anyway. But gaming in Middle-earth is like so many other things, like fan fiction, like making movies, like making music. It's an opportunity to use one's imagination to express a different point of view, a different perspective on how Middle-earth could go, how it could be. And sometimes I do run into gamers who say, "Well, how do you think Tolkien would have allowed a game to work in Middle-earth?" First of all, I'm not so certain he would have allowed a game to work in Middle-earth, because he would have gotten bogged down in trying to lay down the rules, and he never would have finished it. So we would have had another 12-volume work from Christopher Tolkien called The History of the Games of Middle-earth, or something like that. But generally speaking, if you want to create a game in Middle-earth, the rules system, the mechanics, really doesn't matter. You could use something like the D20 system, which is very popular. You could use Rolemaster. You could use Advanced Dungeons & Dragons of any version. You could pretty much use a deck of playing cards. And I don't mean Magic. I mean, you know, like the regular poker playing cards. All you have to do is agree that there are certain limitations to certain things. And then if you want to wander around in Tolkien's world, you just have to stick to the books. And that's where you get into the canonical. The issues of canon, you know, what's official, what's not official, what's authorized, what's not authorized. I once subscribed to a role-playing gamers mailing discussion list, and I won't name the list, where they got into a big discussion about how the Thieves of Tharbad would be organized. And I unsubscribed from the list, and the person who had recommended that I join the list contacted me and said, "Well, what'd you think of it?" And I said, "Well, look what they did to poor Tharbad." I don't see. I think that one thing that gamers do is they get sort of mind locked in certain traditions and parameters. And role playing games, when they were new, and the rules and the concepts were still being freshly invented, they were opening new vistas, new horizons. But as happens with everything, we get comfortable with our old shoes as they get older, and then we start wearing them over and over again, and we stop innovating. And it's okay to have thieves in Middle-earth, because they did have thieves in Middle-earth, but hobbits are not very good thieves. And one of the injustices that have been wreaked upon Tolkien by gaming systems is that they make hobbits into such good thieves. They're not very good thieves. They're too homish, homebodies. I mean, they don't want to go out and mess with the status quo. They want to keep the status quo. So they're really terrible thieves. They're probably much better warriors than people give them credit for, because, for one thing, they can ambush you in endless hordes, as anybody who's read the end of the book, The Lord of the Rings, knows. If you give a hobbit a magic device, he's going to use it in ways that you probably wouldn't even think about. You know, Gollum, he was an exception, I think, because he took the ring and he just went and dug himself a hole under a mountain and stayed there. Bilbo got a hold of the ring, and he became a major hero. Frodo got a hold of the ring, and he took down a major power. So rings of power in the hands of hobbits are very dangerous things, far more dangerous things in the hands of, say, kings of Arnor and Gondor, because Isildur really didn't do anything with it. He was just pretty much a total wuss bag. If I were to put thieves in Middle-earth, I would not really organize them in a guild. That's too medieval. Now, there are certainly a lot of medieval concepts in Middle-earth, and Tolkien had a great deal of knowledge about medieval Europe and medieval Mediterranean, but he didn't limit himself to medieval Europe and things like that. He drew upon ancient sources and modern sources, and I think that his concept of thieves would be a little different. The thieves would not be totally organized in huge guilds, I think they'd probably work in smaller groups, and they probably would not be as well coordinated. The reason being that thieves don't, there is no honor among thieves, you know, and that's an old AD&D tradition, which I don't think many gamers really honored too well. I had a discussion with Hawk about evil gamers, gamers who want to play evil characters, and they do tend to still work as a team for the most part. And Hawk made a point about how, you know, they're evil, they've got to be selfish at some point. And I had a friend who played with an evil group in college, and they all started out at like 7th or 8th level in AD&D, which is pretty powerful stuff. And he came in his first level, and he had to work his way up, and he got trashed in every encounter. But AD&D would let you go in, and you'd hit something, you'd get squatted, and as long as you were healed back to health, you'd get a lot of experience points and go up in levels. And they finally got to a point where they took on something that was too big for them, and everybody in the group died except him, and he was by this time about 10th level. And he killed the last monster and ended up with all the treasure, and all the players are sitting around the table, and they go, okay, so you're going to take us back to town and get us resurrected, right? And he goes, no, I'm going to keep the treasure for myself, and you guys are going to have to roll up new characters and come in as first levels. And that's the way you play an evil character. In Middle-earth, I don't think evil characters would stay grouped together for very long. I mean, depending on what time frame that you're dealing with, let's take the Golden Age of Gondor. There's gold everywhere, jewels line the streets of Gondor. You know, you got to stay pretty much on the fringe of the civilization, because if you go into the inner area, the real criminals are not going to be the low-life, wall-crawling thieves. They're going to be the nobles, the guys who have become corrupt and who are controlling everything else. They'll have henchmen, they'll have thugs, but they're not going to be interested in going out and robbing dungeons. They're the ones who have the dungeons, and they're the ones who are going to be stringing up any idiot who comes, you know, trying to take them to the bank by their thumbs. So thieves in the Golden Age of Gondor are more than likely going to go raiding other peoples and then sneak back into Gondor and use Gondor's power as a protection, a defense. At least in my opinion, that's what I would do, because historically, that's what a lot of thieves did. We called them privateers. Some other countries called them pirates. Sir Francis Drake was a famous privateer for England, and the Spanish really hated him because he was an infamous pirate. Thieves quite often do get used in role-playing games to execute political actions, and I think that Middle-earth would rely heavily on thieves in many different periods. If you take a Second Age scenario, let's say when Sauron invades Eriador, he's going to want some scouts. And we know that the guys living in the forests along the river, who were the ancestors of the Dunlendings and the Men of Bree, helped him to a certain extent. But what if there were some evil guys living up around the Adonic villages who were basically just robbers, and they were tired of starving and being hunted down by their kin, and they saw this huge army coming, and they go up to them and they say, hey, we'll be glad to sell out our relatives for you if you just give us a little gold. I mean, is there historical precedent for that? Absolutely. The ancient Greeks fought the ancient Persians in a place called Thermopylae. And just a few hundred Spartans and a few thousand other Greeks lined up in a little valley and blocked 100,000 Persian soldiers for 3 days until a local shepherd sold them out and showed the Persians how to march over the mountains and come in behind the Spartans. And the Spartans then told all their Greek allies, we've been betrayed. You're more than welcome to go home and save yourselves so that you can live to fight again another day. We'll stand guard in the rear, you know, we'll do the rear guard action and make sure that you get time to get away. The Spartans and I think about 1,100 other Greeks stayed behind, and they were all killed. So that's not the only incident where someone has betrayed their own people for money, but I think thieves would probably be those kinds of brigands and robbers who take advantage of people in a bad position. And sometimes they would be orcs. You know, orcs are often portrayed as thieves and robbers in Tolkien stories, but sometimes they're also men, because there are evil men who set up, little band kingdoms and things like that. And when a big, powerful Dark Lord comes along, they tend to flock around his banner. So if I were to play a game with evil characters in Middle Earth, I would probably want to be the Witch King, you know, as the game ref, who hires this band of thieves to go out and harass the Dunedain of Arnor, or maybe to go down into the Vales of Anduin and harass the Northmen, because his kingdom, Angmar, was situated on both sides of the mountains. If I were role-playing a good party, and somebody wanted to play thieves or something like that, I'd say, okay, but you'd have to be a reformed thief. You can't start out as a bad guy who eventually becomes reformed, as often happens through role play. You have to come in reformed. And the reason why I would do that is no good person would really trust a thief in Middle Earth. They had very stern lines of right and wrong. Now, right and wrong are not always clearly defined. Tolkien really did take a consideration to perspective. If you recall, there's a scene in The Lord of the Rings where Sam and Frodo see part of a battle between Faramir's rangers of Ithilien and a group of Southerlings who have come marching up the highway to reinforce Mordor. And one of the Southerlings is killed and his body rolls down the hill, and Sam looks at him and he wonders, you know, why is this guy here? Why did he march all the way to this land just so he could die? Was he compelled to do so, or did he come for lust of gold or something like that? Maybe he was a mercenary or something like that. But the implication is Sam leaves some possibility in his mind that the guy really wasn't evil, that he might possibly have been thinking that he was doing a good thing. And there's a recent story on Stargate SG-1, which I watch every week, with two groups of ancient beings. There are the ancients who have ascended and become sort of godlike beings, and then there are the Ori in another galaxy who have ascended and become godlike beings. And when we first meet the Ori, we are told that they're very evil, and we're shown how they basically torture anyone that they disagree with and want to kill everybody that they disagree with. But now we've advanced through the show enough that we know a little bit more about the Ori. Their believers actually think that the Ori are very righteous and just creatures. They look out for their followers' best interests. They keep the crops flowing, and you know, life is pretty stable. There are occasional rebellions, and the Ori put them down. And now they've sent the Ori followers, the followers of Origin, a sort of savior in the form of a little girl who everyone assumes is in one of the Ori in physical form. And she had a discussion with her mother, who comes from this galaxy, and you know, they're both trying to tell each other, well, you're serving the side of evil, and they were using the same arguments to try and persuade each other. In Middle Earth, it would be much the same thing. Take the kin strife. Let's say that you set a role-playing game in the time of the kin strife, when you have the kings of Gondor fighting the rebellious leaders of Gondor who want to preserve the bloodline. Who's right? The kings who have flaunted Numenorean tradition and gone out and married the Northmen, or the purebred Numenoreans, right, who want to preserve as much of their culture and tradition as possible? Both sides are thinking that they are just, that they have the cause of right on their side, and they both kill a lot of, you know, each other's followers. In the end, the kings of Gondor prevail, and they kick their cousins out, and they go take over the Haven of Umbar, and they eventually intermarry with local families and do exactly what they criticized the kings of Gondor for doing. So who's right and who is wrong in that? You can say that the war was a criticism of racism, which it really is, but Tolkien was trying to show two sides of the issue, and he showed that the side that won out did